Welcome to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We are Flipper, the Family Law Practitioners Association of Queensland. Family law is a wonderfully rewarding career, but is not without its challenges. Join us as we explore the issues that impact on the practice and well-being of family law practitioners. We hope our episodes will not only inform and inspire you, but encourage you to reach your potential. Enjoy this episode.
Hello, thank you for joining us today. My name is Helen Davison. I'm a barrister and a proud member of the Flipper Board. Today I have the pleasure of interviewing recently retired Judge of the Queensland District Court and Judge of the Planning and Environment Court, Judge Michael Rackman. Judge commenced practice as a solicitor in 1988 and joined the Queensland Bar 2 years later. At the bar, he specialised in planning and environment law and was known as the leading barrister in the area. In 2004, at the young age of 39, he was appointed a judge of the Queensland District Court and judge of the Planning and Environment Court. Last year, he retired from the bench after 20 years of service. During his time as a judge on the Planning and Environment Court, Judge introduced significant changes to the court's practices and procedures. So innovative were those changes that he became a sought-after international speaker on specialised environment courts, including advising the United Nations. Welcome, Judge, to Flipper Talks.
Thanks for inviting me.
In 2022, you presented an address to the Bundaberg District Law Association Conference entitled How to Infuriate a Judge and Not How to Guide. The paper was later published in the Queensland Bar's publication Hearsay and has been widely shared because of its constructive advice. Judge, why did you write that paper?
It was written for the Bundaberg Conference. It being a general conference, it wasn't an appropriate conference to write a Planning and Environment Court paper for. It was written to be helpful, as I say in the paper. I'm very conscious of the assistance that judges get from the legal profession. It wasn't written to be a general piece being upset about the profession. I'm also very conscious that judges are far from perfect ourselves. But I thought that if I wrote a paper which collected illustrations and examples of things that the judges themselves find to be annoying or infuriating, then that might be of assistance to practitioners to see through the eyes of the judge, what they are doing or some of the things that they are doing that annoy us, because ultimately the role of a practitioner appearing before a court is not just to do something, but to do something persuasively. And you need to bear in mind the judge, what the judge's task is to do, and how you can assist the judge in doing that in a way which hopefully results in the relief you're seeking or in resisting the relief that you're trying to resist. And so you need to think about the judge and how the judge is reacting to what you're doing. And hopefully by setting out some of this, it would assist practitioners to avoid the things that have a negative reaction from the judge's perspective.
Thank you. And having spoken to your colleagues and your time on the bench, what would you say are the most common ways that legal practitioners do, in fact, infuriate judges?
Thankfully, some of the things that are the most annoying are not that common. So the things that really send us off the deep end, of course, are people who are simply dishonest with us or quite clearly misleading us or deceiving us or who are being openly contemptuous of the institution or the office. Thankfully, those examples are fairly rare. In terms of the things I speak about in the paper, I suppose there are a number of things which would come under the heading of etiquette-type matters. You know, there's not turning up on time. There's a whole range of matters of etiquette before the court that are annoying and that are fairly common. And in doing that part of the paper, I was conscious that perhaps some of the younger practitioners in particular are just not aware of some of the matters of court etiquette these days, because there's a smaller proportion of the profession these days who regularly appears in court, and maybe some of the matters of court etiquette are not being passed on to the younger practitioners. So I thought, particularly with those court etiquette type of matters, that may be helpful to for them to be set out so that people are aware of all of them. So there are these sort of court etiquette type matters. In addition to that, though, a lot of the other things I would say fall under the broad heading of just not being helpful to the judge. So the judge is there obviously to, first of all, work out what the judge is being asked to do or to consider, to look at what the evidence is, to focus upon what the judge needs to focus on in order to determine the case, to understand the competing arguments, to reach a decision and give some reasons for it. Now, that's the process the judge has to go through. But if you're appearing before the judge and your material is ill-prepared so that it doesn't cover the matters that have to be covered, or if you are ill-prepared so that you turn up and you don't know what rule you're applying under, or you can't help the judge with the things the judge has to be satisfied of in order to give you the relief, or you've given the judge an affidavit which is bulky and isn't paginated, so the judge can't find the evidence that the judge needs to look at in order to be satisfied, they're all examples of things that are in the paper, then you're simply not being helpful. The judge gets frustrated because the judge has a list, he's got other people waiting, or she's got other people waiting, and the judge wants to get on with the job. The judge wants to be able to find, you know, what's the relief you're seeking, what have I got to consider, where's the material, what are the arguments, how do I decide this? And if you're not in a position to help the judge with that because of those sorts of errors which I've already referred to, or others that are referred to in the paper, then the judge gets very irritated and agitated about that, gets very frustrated about it. Mm. So, again, you've got to look at not just what you're doing, but how are you doing it persuasively? How are you helping the judge to get to a position where the judge can grant you the relief you're seeking, or, you know, resisting as the case may be? Mm. I remember when I was a very young barrister and I was being led in a big case by a wise senior silk, and I said to him early in the piece, I said, how do you want to split responsibility in this case for dealing with different parts of it? And he said to me, I think we'll do the usual split up. I said, what's that? He said, your job is to win the case. And it was a long pregnant pause, and then he said, my job is to win the judge. And he was being somewhat you know, jokingly, mm. but only somewhat, because mm. it was to make the point that as a practitioner appearing in court, you've got to think about not just what you're doing, but you've got to think about the judge you're presenting the case to and how they're going to receive it. And so my hope was, in doing this paper, not just would people be able to avoid the particular things that annoy the judge, but they would start to think about how their conduct and how their presentation of the case is going to sit with the judge and affect the judge. Mm. Because a lot of the errors that you see from particularly inexperienced practitioners is that they've been thinking so much about what they need to do in a sort of a tick a box thing, mm. but they don't think so much about how they can assist the judge. Mm. And that assisting the judge is the first step towards persuading the judge. And ultimately, that's what you want to do. You want to be persuasive.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you. That's helpful. And the article, particularly, well, in all aspects, but on that court etiquette, is very helpful, I think, particularly for junior practitioners. It's not uncommon in family law that, you know, first, second year lawyers are being sent up for mentions and the like. And I think, as you say, if they're not guided about court etiquette, they're generally not things that are always taught at university. And so having an article like yours, which is very prescriptive and doesn't just say, well, you should just know the court etiquette, but actually sets it out, it is very helpful, not just for young people, also more experienced. I think something like advocacy is, it's a skill, and we can always, I think it doesn't matter what level you're at, you can always improve. though again...
Yes, that's true. It is a learning experience. The longer you do it, the more you do learn. But as you say, it did occur to me when I was writing this that maybe, particularly with some of the junior practitioners, we're getting annoyed with them for not doing things that they've never been told to do.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. One of the things you mentioned in the article is about frankness and the need not only to be honest but also not to mislead. When you were on the bench and you asked a practitioner a question which perhaps it was quite clear they didn't know the answer to, for example, you may have raised a case and the practitioner, let's say, has never heard of the case, let alone read it. What is the best way? Do you have any advice for practitioners when they're in that situation and it's a deer caught in the headlights type of situation, how best they can respond to a question like that?
Well, frankness is always the best policy. So if a judge is asking you about a case, what submission you want to make about it, and it's a case you're not familiar with, the best thing is say, look, I'm sorry, Your Honour, but I'm not familiar with the case. And then you can... offer, you can say, depending on the circumstance, you can say, well, if Your Honour were minded to stand down the case for a short time, the matter for a short time, I can read the case and make a submission, or I can, if Your Honour pleases, I could send a supplementary written submission to Your Honour. Mm-hmm. And that's up to the court how they want to deal with it. But again, you know, fess up, say you're not aware, you can offer to give the court the option, offer to remediate it in that way, and then it's up to the judge to move forward. But for goodness sake, don't pretend that you do know it when you don't.
Yeah, thank you. That's wise advice. You also mentioned in the article in relation to submissions that judges can be irritated by submissions when important evidence or relevant law, particularly contrary to your case, is ignored rather than confronted. Mm-hmm. I mean, just focusing on confronting those difficult aspects of your case, could you give us a bit more advice about those matters?
Well, again, what are you trying to achieve in your submissions? This is your opportunity to persuade the judge to decide the matter your way. So what is the judge going to have to do at the end of the day? The judge is going to have to comprehend both sides of the argument, and then the judge is going to have to resolve how to decide the matter by either choosing between the two of them or quite often reconciling one with the other or the like. But either way, the judge is going to have to deal with both arguments, and the judge is going to have to work through both arguments in order to get to the conclusion in the case. So if all you do is deal with your evidence and your positive case, but completely ignore the evidence that's against you, completely ignore any cases that are against you, and completely ignore the other side's submissions, then you're effectively abandoning the playing field. You're giving the judge no assistance, and the judge, when the time comes for the judge to actually decide the case, the judge effectively has no assistance from you. You want to be telling the judge how to reconcile your case and the other side's case in a way where you win and they lose. So it makes no sense at all to completely ignore the evidence which is against you, the case which is against you, the authorities. In relation to persuasive authorities the other way, you should be raising them for the court's attention anyway. But it makes no sense from an advocacy perspective. And it annoys the judge for the same reason, because it's unhelpful. Because, again, the judge is looking to the practitioners for assistance. The judge, as I say, the judge will have to resolve the competing cases, resolve the competing evidence and the like. And so the judge is looking forward to submissions for assistance. And when you get a piece of paper that just sort of ignores half the case, it's of no assistance to you. And it's annoying for that reason.
And if you've thought of a way, say there's a leading case that's against you, but you are going to attempt to explain to the judge as to why the facts are different or shouldn't be applied in this case.
Distinguishable or
yes,
et cetera.
Is that something that is generally helpful to the court to often address up front? Because perhaps if it's quite glaring that if that's not...
It's a matter of judgment in each case, you know. Sometimes you'll say, look, I'll deal first of all with this point, mm-hmm. to one side, and then move on. Sometimes you'll, it's just a matter, there's no golden rule. It's a matter of individual, you know, judgment in each case about where you want to deal with particular points. But can I tell you, it's not related to this particular question you asked me, but there was another silk that I worked a lot with when I was at the bar. And in terms of whether we confronted particular evidence or a particular point that we may have had to confront, we may not have had to confront in terms of leading more evidence in a case, I never saw an occasion where the silk chose anything other than confronting it.
Mm.
And I can never remember an instance where that wasn't the right answer.
Mm, mm.
It's usually better to confront and explain than it is to try to hope that no one will see it.
Yes, yes. And I've certainly seen too in oral submissions where an advocate is making submissions about all the great, you know, the great aspects of their case, and the judge just says, deal with this. Mm. You know, this is, don't you have a problem? And I'm aware of all those great points, but really at the heart of the, you know, the matter is this glaring issue in your case.
The other thing I didn't cover in that, but just because a judge is asking you questions while you're on your feet and the judge is probing you doesn't necessarily mean the judge is against you. Mm-hmm. I, more than a lot of judges, used to ask probing questions mm-hmm. during submissions. And sometimes the party I was probing the most was the party that I had a preliminary view should succeed.
Okay.
Because I was wanting to test the argument to make sure that it wasn't, you know, it didn't have any holes in it. Mm. I used to look forward to the submissions time because that's the time that I had the barristers there to help me in my task of working out how everything should be resolved and in my own mind and how I should reconcile all the competing evidence and the competing arguments and the like. So I used to look forward to that time so that I could test them all
mm.
and that would be of assistance to me. But certainly if someone just simply wouldn't deal with an issue or wouldn't deal with the other side's argument itself, that's terribly frustrating.
Yes. Something I find when I'm doing it, that's quite – all the family lawyers out there will be nodding because that's quite often what happens with our closing submissions or an interim hearing. There's a lot of questions – sometimes, particularly in a closing submissions, you obviously go in with oral submissions written out, the issues and the order that you want to deal, had planned to deal with it. Mm. And then perhaps you have a judge that has a lot of questions for you. Mm. Did you find it more helpful to just have those questions answered rather than someone say, oh, well, actually, you're not asking in the order or I'm going to deal with that later? Like, how did you find most helpful as a judge?
I'm going to deal with that later. It was usually the words used by someone who had no intention of coming back to it later.
Okay, yes.
I suppose I was one of those judges who I would get the written submissions beforehand and I would read them.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinarily I would go into court. I would probably demonstrate by giving a bit of a summary that I had actually read them all.
Mm-hmm.
And so the barristers were pretty used to me coming in saying, look, I've read all of this. Now, this is what I want to hit. You know, these are the questions I've got. And then I would ask questions, and by the time we'd finished that discussion, I'd say, is there anything you wanted to sort of add? Mm-hmm. You can say whatever you want. And ordinarily by that time, they'd say, no, I think we've covered it all.
Mm-hmm.
So my particular style was one more of reading the stuff in advance and then asking questions. So I don't think the barristers before me had much of an opportunity at the start to read out their set screed. But
mm-hmm.
That wasn't because I wanted to stop them. It's just because I had actually read it and absorbed it before we started.
But, mm. Yes, and I guess there's things you don't necessarily need to hear about because you've already read
and they knew that. And they knew, in my case, a very document-heavy jurisdiction, they knew that I would take it away and read it all again anyway and that sort of stuff, and they trusted that I would actually do that. So
yes, okay. Now that's helpful. Do you have any tips about how a barrister can hopefully not infuriate a judge through cross-examination?
Cross-examination, I suppose you've got to know your judge a bit, because judges have their different sort of likes and dislikes. But cross-examination obviously is a time when a witness is tested. A bit of it depends upon how crucial that witness is. If you've got an important witness, I never like to see just formal cross-examination. I put it to you this, I put it to you that, I put it to you the other way. I'd like to see the witness tested, because I'll need, again, to be making a decision about whether I accept or reject the witness's evidence or part of it or whatever. So I want to see the witness properly tested. At the same time, I don't want the cross-examination to be needlessly repetitive and time-consumptive, but I'd like to see the witness properly tested. I don't want to see any unfairness to the witness. I don't want to see the witness's answers cut off. I don't want to see questions, you know, rolled up, or the effect of the witness's earlier answers misstated in the next question to the witness, those sorts of things. It's often said to people in lectures these days that cross-examination doesn't have to be cross. You certainly don't need to be, I don't like people yelling at witnesses or the like, not be abusive of witnesses. But that doesn't mean you can't be firm and strong in your cross-examination. How firm and how strong, as I said, again, that probably depends a bit on it, knowing your judge a bit. I probably liked a bit more firmness than some other judges did.
Okay.
It depends a bit on knowing your judge and being a matter of judgment on the day. But again, as I say, I look at it again from the perspective of what's going to help the judge and what you're trying to achieve in terms of your persuasion. And if it's an important witness or a witness of some substance, you want to see them tested and challenged in a fair but robust way, so that you can make a decision about whether their evidence is reliable or not.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. Apart from dealing with some lawyers, what are the challenges that judges face in their roles?
There's all sorts of things that can constrain your conduct generally, both in and out of court. I suppose in terms of the court more specifically, I think the day-to-day challenge, irrespective of what jurisdiction you're sitting in, is that whilst we're all human beings, and the human beings have your good days and your bad days, and the days that, you know, you're a bit angsty and the days that you're a bit more mellow, every litigant in every case deserves to have you deciding your case in accordance with your judicial oath as best you can. So I often used to remind myself before I walked into court each day that you've got to try each and every day to put all of your baggage in the bin at the door and walk into the court each day doing your level best to run things fairly and try to get to the right result, which is effectively what you're supposed to do as a judge. And by human beings, there are days when perhaps you're better at that than others. But the integrity of the job is its greatest reward, and the integrity of the job really lies in your day-to-day commitment to that oath. So that's the thing that I constantly reminded myself of. In terms of specific challenges for specific jurisdictions, if you're in a judgment-heavy jurisdiction like civil jurisdiction or planning and environment or the like, then it's the judgment writing. The judges that are in a judgment-heavy jurisdiction, 100% number one item on the challenge is getting those judgments written and getting them down on time. I haven't met a single person who, having been made a judge, didn't find that they'd underestimated the work and effort involved in judgment writing. Mm. When you get there, you can't know until you have to do it how much time and effort is involved. It is really much more than you think before you have to do it. So that's probably the biggest burden on you, the judgment's hanging over your head all the time. If you're running a list, as I had to, as I did, I was happy to do it, in relation to the planning environment courts, it's just being on top of the statistics, making sure the workloads or the case flow is getting through and is being efficient, and making sure that everything's running efficiently and well and that sort of stuff. So there's that as well. If you're in a jurisdiction which is not judgment writing heavy, something like crime, for example, I think the challenge of crime, and I imagine I don't have really any experience of family law, but I imagine family law is a bit like this as well. There's just experiencing the trauma of the subject matter. Mm. So when I was first appointed, I didn't have very much exposure to crime at all. But all of a sudden, I'm running criminal trials and doing sentences where the subject matter is you know, very traumatic. And although I'm not living that trauma as the victims are and the like, you know, it's still stuff that does leave an impression upon you. Mm. And I imagine in family law there are some terrible, you know, traumatic circumstances as well that would weigh heavily upon you at the time until you learn to, you know, adjust and be able to, you know, sustainably deal with that sort of subject matter.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you. I guess those challenges, and particularly what you raised around family law and criminal law and the subject matters that they're dealing with, I guess the type of things that can also impact on a judge's health and mental health and things like that as well.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
Mm. And I think there's been some studies recently. I think the New South Wales Judicial Commission did a study and found there was 83.6% of judicial officers reported at least one symptom of secondary traumatic stress in the week prior to the survey. So, yeah, it's probably not surprising given the content of some of the matters that they're dealing with can cause it traumatic stress.
I was very fortunate that in my first year on the court, when I started to have to deal with this sort of subject matter, that one of the experienced judges gave me some advice, which she was giving to me as a new judge who was fairly fresh to that area, which you know, helped me deal with that. It encouraged me to, you know, focus on the fact that, you know, I had a particular role to play in the process, and encouraged me to focus on the fact that, you know, I'd done my role to the best of my ability, and that's really all I could do. Mm. And that sort of helped me in being able to deal with the fact that there was all that sort of trauma more broadly in the cases that came before me.
Mm, yeah, and I think even as advocates, I mean, we're obviously exposed to similar content, but particularly in family law and, you know, in colleagues in crime as well. And the way that I look at it is often when it comes to my desk, and no doubt then before the court, often it's the point, for example, in a family law case of domestic violence and family violence, actually the point in time that something is actually being addressed in a sense. And so the way I often look at what I do in my work is, you know, sometimes I'm acting for the victim, sometimes I'm acting for the perpetrator, but this issue that's been going on for perhaps years is actually being addressed, and that can be quite a helpful thing for a person or people, the litigants involved in that it's, they're getting some orders in place and they're getting a resolution. It may not actually be the resolution that they hope for. It might be something different. But even sometimes I think a resolution to the issue is in fact quite helpful for people, and that it's being addressed, it's out in the open. And so from more of an advocate's perspective, to be part of that and kind of the accumulation of all the years of work that perhaps social workers, psychologists, family members have put in supporting, say, somebody through that, to then be at the end and seeing really an outcome can actually be quite rewarding for professionally, but also where it does go in your client's favour, whatever that is. It's obviously you know, a rewarding outcome for them as well. So, yeah, I guess there's different ways to look at it, and that we're one part in dealing with these issues in society. And I think that's good advice, is just taking what you can do in your role. We can't solve all the world's problems, but we can do our part.
Responsibility for everything that's happened over the entire period.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I think that's really helpful. You shared in your valedictory speech that you had some health issues during your time on the bench, and thanked those who supported you, especially your wife Margaret. Would you mind sharing some of those experiences?
Yeah, well, I was on the bench for a little over 20 years, and I enjoyed good health, both physical and mental, for roughly the first third and also for roughly the last third. But I had a bit of a bumpy road in the middle. So I had a number of physical health incidents and concerns, and one of those was developing some adult epilepsy. Manifest itself initially in a seizure, which happened at home, which itself resulted in a life-threatening situation. It wasn't really at that time diagnosed as adult epilepsy. And then a year later, actually when I was on circuit in Bundaberg, I suffered my second one in the Woolworths supermarket when I was getting some food for my groceries on circuit. And I ended up in the emergency department of the Bundaberg Hospital. It's after that that I was diagnosed with epilepsy, and I have been medicated since such that it's all under control. But that really came at the end of a period of quite a few health challenges. And not long after that, and perhaps somewhat contributed to by those sort of physical health things, I, out of the blue, as it were, in an totally unexpected but in a very, very sudden way, suffered some depression. Mm. And it's something that affected me quite seriously for some months, which were thankfully fell during the Christmas break and a bit either side. Mm. And then affected me to a reasonable extent, but not quite as acutely, over a more extended period. Mm. A period that was very, very difficult, because I was working and dealing with that depression over that period of time. And that was an enormously difficult period of my life. And it's something that was only known by a small number of people at the time. You know, obviously the head of jurisdiction, who had to be satisfied that I was fine to work, by a few judges, and obviously my wife and a few sort of support people. It's something, though, that I decided to acknowledge publicly for the first time at my valedictory, and I did that after a great deal of thought. And I decided to do it because I thought that it would be wrong to allow my valedictory speech to go past without properly thanking the people who had supported me, particularly my wife, mm. who really walked the journey with me on a day-to-day basis. And I couldn't really thank her and the others properly without revealing what it is that I had gone through. Mm. So that's really the reason that I acknowledged it at the time. I was a little apprehensive about what the reaction to that would be, but I was very much comforted by the response, which has only been positive from anybody who has spoken to me about that disclosure.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very powerful for someone, you know, in your position, and to share these, because it is quite common, I think, for people to suffer this. And I think the biggest lies often people tell themselves is that they're alone and they're the only one going through it. And so certainly must be comforting to others to know that, hear a bit about your story, that who might be going through it as well. If someone is going through that currently, I mean, do you have any
well, advice? It's very confronting at first because, A, it's very sudden. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one day I'm fine and, you know, within a couple of days, you know, you're anything but. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're used to being a very robust person. Mm-hmm. You know, the person who pushes himself the hardest, the person who can carry the workload, the person who gets things done. And yet, all of a sudden, you're struck down. Mm. You feel incapable of doing any of it. You don't know why at the time. And you don't know how long it'll last, if it'll ever pass. It's not like, you know, it's a broken leg or something where people say, this is the healing time. You feel embarrassed. Mm-hmm. You feel in a way trapped because you think, well, if anyone knows about this, you know, no one will ever want to have a case heard by me ever in the future. And you lose self-confidence and you lose your personality. You know, we didn't tell the children until after I had recovered, although they clearly worked out something was wrong. Mm. Because you're not your usual, you know, effervescent self, you're pretty much a blank personality at the time. And so things are just so different, and you're fatigued because the adrenaline and cortisol is running all during your waking hours. You know, you get physically tired, so you're fatigued all the time. And all these things are happening to you, which is, completely, you know, confronting. Mm. And all you want to do is get back to normal and get back to your work, and you feel as though, you know, I certainly felt as if I was, you know, letting the team down, as it were. But the thing I would say is really important is that you have to, well, you know something's wrong, so there's no good denying that, but you have to take the help. Mm. So you've got to take the medical help, and you've got to take the help of the people around you, and you've just got to take it day at a time. And that's what I did. And my wife was very good at saying, look, don't be focused upon when you'll recover. Just, you know, you have permission to be sick for a little while. Mm. You know, just let's day at a time. Mm. You know, so I'd just take it. In fact, I take even each part of each day at a time. Mm. And you know, you get through each part of each day, and you wake up the next day, and you do that day, and then you do the next day, and you take the help. And sure enough, once you take, you know, you might be able to see yourself, you know, completing a 10-kilometre walk, but if you just do one step each day, you know, over time, you get to the end point. Mm. And I was so pleased that I did get to the end point, and the last roughly third of my judicial career was spent in good physical and mental health, and I'm enormously grateful for the help and support that I received. And that's what I would say. I'd say take the help and just take it a step at a time. You know, I learned very quickly that I was not the first or only judge ever to have suffered this. Mm. And there was one or two others that had suffered it that got in contact with me, that you can and will recover, but don't put pressure on yourself about the time frame for that. And just take the help and just take it one step at a time and you'll get there.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you. And, I mean, how important was it having people around you supporting you?
Oh, hugely important, because obviously the head of jurisdiction, you know, was enormously supportive, but they help in two ways, I suppose. They help in taking pressure off you, in emphasising to you that you have the permission to be sick. Mm. And second of all, in just getting you to not be impatient with yourself or down on yourself, just to be there with you, you know, each and every day. Mm. You know, just, as I say, the day-by-day approach. Mm. And just getting you there day by day.
Mm. Yeah, that's wonderful. Mm. Yeah. It's such a blessing to have supportive colleagues and family and a partner to, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah. You know, and that's why, since it had been such a difficult thing, limited in time as it was, but, you know, it was an elongated period. Like, it was, it wasn't just, you know, a week or two or a month or two. It was a more elongated period than that. But even though it came and it went, it was nevertheless a very testing time. Mm-hmm. And I thought to finish my career and give a valedictory speech without any reference to it, and more particularly without any reference to the support that I had received, would have been a little bit artificial.
Mm. Thank you, Judge, for sharing that very personal experience with us. I trust that it will help people who are listening and might be facing something similar. And, or as you say, I mean, we just unfortunately never know what life holds for us. And it might be that even in the future that people reflect on your experience, yeah. and also the hope that, you know, you did get through it, as difficult as it was, and you're able to share about that experience. I think there's a lot of power in that.
And can I just underscore, please, if you suffer anything like this, please get the help, because I certainly don't want to be out there preaching about this all the time. But I did agree to come on this podcast to speak something about this, because it might be able to help others. And it's not just my experience in that regard, but I had a very close personal friend who was a solicitor, a very successful solicitor. And we were at school together, and he had some problems which he did not seek help for. Mm. I spoke at his funeral last year. It's just so important that if you have these problems, that it's just an illness. There are people who can help you, and you can get through it and be healthy again.
Mm.
Don't make your illness chronic by failing to take the help.
Mm. Great advice. Thank you, Judge. And as I said, I certainly, and half of Flipper, certainly appreciate your time today and talking about such important topics. So thank you, and all the best with retirement to you and Margaret.
Yes, I describe it as a stress-less business rather than a stressful business.
Something we can all aspire to one day.
Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you. If any of the topics that we have discussed today have caused you distress, or if you would like to seek help in relation to mental health issues, the Queensland Law Society has a service available called Law Care. Law Care can be accessed by telephoning 1-800-177-743. That's 1-800-177-743, and the QLS website has more information about that. If you are a barrister and a member of the Bar Association of Queensland, there is a Bar Care available. Bar Care provides 3 free consultations per year to barristers on a confidential basis, and you can contact BarCare via the Queensland by logging on to the Queensland Bar website. Alternatively, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14 for 24/7 support, or call the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467. Otherwise, we would recommend that you seek medical help from your medical practitioner. Thank you again for being with us, Judge Rackerman. We really appreciate, or I really appreciate, your openness and bravery in sharing about your story, and I'm confident it will help so many people. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. We confirm that the information we discussed today was just that, information for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not specific advice. If something discussed has you considering whether you should take steps, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or other advice. Please reach out to Flipper if there's another topic you'd like explored, and if you know someone who might benefit from the show, remember to tell them about it. Thank you for listening.